Yesterday, we were looking at this subject of citta, or the heart mind, as it's often translated, sometimes referred to as the base or seat of consciousness. And we said a couple of things about it. One, that, well, we use that iceberg analogy to say that actually of the heart mind, only a fraction of it is ever visible at any one time. There's an awful lot that we don't see that's actually going on, and that there are forces in that hidden part that we don't see that actually very much impinge on our everyday and daily experience. And the other thing we said about it was that what we are conscious of is continuously changing, rather like a flow, coming to be and ceasing to be, coming to be and ceasing to be. And the forces that bring about the things that we experience, what we call our everyday life, that is directed or piloted, if you like, driven by forces often that we are quite unaware of. And so things arise and pass away, moods and emotional states and strange obsessions and odd compulsions that grip us from time to time. We have some fancy idea about something and we run off with it, and then it suddenly leaves us and we wonder where it's gone. We embark on a new relationship and it all seems so wonderful at the beginning, and then after about 6 months, when we suddenly begin to realize that the wet towels left in the middle of the bathroom and the empty milk bottle put back into the fridge door actually really does get on my nerves now, and it never used to. And when suddenly I go to my dearest and say, for the good of the relationship, you know, please don't put wet towels in the middle of the floor. Please, will you put the top back on the toothpaste? Please don't put empty milk bottles back in the fridge. It's so annoying when I want something, my coffee first thing in the morning. And not only do I find my beloved's not particularly interested in my shopping list, actually has a shopping list with all my faults and failings on it too. And that's when the scales really have dropped from our eyes, and now where do we go from here? Are we still so gripped by that idealized person that now we get shot of them and go running off to find somebody else I can now plonk it on and run after them? Or do we realize that actually it was a very idealized thing that had got us, and that actually in this world of light and dark, good and bad, a world that according to the Buddha in the First Noble Truth is imperfect, at least to my standards, and therefore it is never going to be entirely satisfactory to my experience, and perhaps weighing this against that, decide that the relationship is worth pursuing after all, warts and all, in other words. And so these strange things that grip us and come and go, this is what we experience. This is our daily experience. But the forces that actually produce all this, much of it is actually hidden from us. So that was those are some of the things that we looked at yesterday. And the other thing that was suggested, because this is a practice talk, it's not just painting nice word pictures, about taking the Buddha's final words, strive on heedfully. Heedfully meaning carefully, meaning with care, with real care and warmth as well, to handle things with care, to deal with people with care as well, and true consideration. And that if we did this, we would find that in fact it would be impossible not to give ourselves. And so to give ourselves into this, being as careful as we possibly can with what can we come across. Has anybody given it a go? No? Good. Remember what was said about hearing with the ear, pondering in the heart, and putting into practice with the body, and how we often get stuck not going on to that last one, actually putting it into practice. Did anybody even just close a door carefully within the 24 hours? Excellent. Well, you have had it. You don't need to be shy. That's excellent. That's really good. 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 And just for those who did do either close a door or put a cup down carefully, even if it was just that one thing, was it noticed just how it really did involve the body? It wasn't possible to sort of, come like this. I mean, actually, to pay attention to something isn't just a mental activity. We often think paying attention is just a mental activity. And very much for us in the West, we feel that there's a split, don't we, between mental functioning and the physical nature of the body. And actually, in Buddhism, these two things are seen very much as, well, palm and back of hand, or two sides of the same coin, really. That actually, if we are going to be careful, if we're going to give ourselves into that really being careful, that we have to bring the whole of ourselves into it, which means bring the heart on the inside, but also the body as well with it. That's what we mean by wholeheartedness. And this is now something that we can also go into a little bit as well, developing that practice of carefulness, that really putting our body into it, into the closing and the opening of something. It's perfectly possible, picking up and putting down a cup, to actually be at one with that, to be at one with what the body is actually doing. And to be careful, please, because there are a couple of, or there's one particular caveat for this, being at one with, and a little bit because we hear terms like mindfulness. Personally prefer the term awareness, because awareness has a sort of an immediate aspect to it, where mindful almost sounds slightly ruminating, you know, cogitating something a little bit. And there's that feeling that if I'm cogitating about picking the cup up, that I'm actually standing one back from it. I don't know, I don't think I'm completely alone in that sense. Whereas awareness, there's that actually direct at oneness with it. If it's being a little bit stand back, if I'm sort of thinking, right, now my fingers are just lightly touching the cup and I lift up and I take a sip and then down. It's awkward, isn't it? I mean, you really couldn't live your life like that. And a little bit, I mean, for example, going into the meditation hall, as Venerable Sogan mentioned the other day, when we bow at the threshold, either coming in or going out, there's that little bit of self-consciousness sometimes where I'm trying to bow best. It can go either, there are two extremes here, which is why the Buddha taught the middle way, of course. There are two extremes here. One is to do it blindly. So just literally go in like this and then toddle off over here. And really, I'm just more thinking about where I'm going to sit or to put the bag somewhere else or whatever. And the other one is now to feel that all eyes are on me. And I sort of, I have to stand up, I think, really, to do this. But, you know, and so, Anders, you're the Buddha Rupa. Okay, that's all right. Yes, look, Buddha Rupa-ish. Okay, and now, because I don't actually see the Buddha Rupa, because all I'm looking at actually is myself, and it goes down, down, and you can almost hear the wood creaking as it goes down like this, and it stops, and then it comes up, and up, and up, and up, and it stops like that. And then it gets up. It's like, whew, it's over. That's not bringing the body, that's not the wholeheartedness with the body that we're talking about. Actually, there's a natural flow to it, that the body just does, gives, and then goes off. You see, it looked different. It feels different. There's a real sense of going with it, a real sense of flowing with it, a real sense of oneness. And because the body is always in the here and now, it's never anywhere else, it is so dependable that if we give ourselves into the body and give ourselves into what the body is doing, even if we're just sitting here, the body is doing that. There's a feeling of sitting here. Don't have to be moving. Just give ourselves into the sitting and the listening or the speaking or the drinking or the opening and the closing of the doors. But really stay with the body. Really stay with that feeling that's in the body. It changes quite naturally. And a little bit, we begin to discover a few things. For example, being at home now, a little bit more in the body, we might notice that restlessness that was talked about yesterday, which has a technical term in Buddhism, is called dukkha, which is often translated as suffering, but has a much wider meaning than just physical suffering. It can mean that restlessness, it can mean a sense of dissatisfaction, it can mean a sense of unfulfillment or a feeling of a lack, or that sort of sense of hurry and getting on instead of being given in to what at this moment is being done. There's always this, the thoughts are carrying to the next thing, to the already I'm thinking about the next thing whilst I'm still doing this, you know. As a friend of mine always says, when he's drunk half a pint of beer, he says, I'm already looking forward to the second. And it's that sort of, but with that bit of passion behind it, that little bit of a fire that drives it. And if we're living in the body, then we begin to recognize those compulsions, that compulsive thing, that there's something driving that restlessness. And it has a definite feel to it that we can become thoroughly familiar with. We can describe it in all sorts of ways, but there's nothing like the experience of it to really bring it home. And when we become aware of that restlessness, we find that it can, rather like the heat dial on an oven, it can go up very hot or it can be turned down quite cool, depending on circumstances. Some circumstances really trigger things off and it can get quite frantic. And this is now where the practice of restraint comes in, because restraint is the discipline. What we are doing is we're providing a container within which these fires can safely come up. And if these fires can safely come up, that means that we acknowledge them in consciousness, which is why yesterday we were it was mentioned so much about this. Rather than worrying about what I want to be, what I'd like to be, and all my little vanities in that direction, actually just opening up and saying yes to what in fact is right now, and as much as possible to be satisfied with that, instead of loading it with all my judgments of, I don't like this, I don't want to be like this. And all, well, this is how it is. It's raining, as Master Dogen was mentioned last night. And he gave another verse that said, the petals fall even though we don't want them to. The weeds spring up even though we detest them. That's just how it is. Well, those petals and those weeds are in us and in others and in everything. They are our judgments. They're my judgments of things that I like and I don't like. I want, I don't want. I stand, I cannot stand. Should not. Must, mustn't. Also, all those sorts of things that when they're fired up in that way. This is not to say that all behaviour, and just this needs to be put in, I'm saying it, but hopefully shouldn't be, should be fairly clear. This is not to say that everything is now permitted. Everything now can be done. It's not. Our actions have moral consequences, but our feelings do not. Our feelings karmically have no consequences at all. They're simply the fruit of previous actions, according to karmic doctrine. Our actions, however, have very serious consequences. So what comes up on the inside, to feel what comes up and to acknowledge it, quite all right, whatever it is. But to act it out, well, no, obviously we're moral beings. And so we have, that is our container with those two things. And really when it comes down to it, a training, a spiritual training, that is what a spiritual training is. It's that insight into the movements and the presences and the shape of and the colour of the heart right now. And now, and now, and on the outside as much as possible to behave in a human way. And in fact, it's not just people on a spiritual path who necessarily have to do this. Actually, anybody who wishes to develop a skill to a high standard has to do it. Sports people have to do it. Artists have to do it. Musicians have to do it. particularly classically trained ones as well, particularly if they're playing with others in an orchestra, say. And I remember those of you who know Roberta Mansell, who's an artist and who is illustrating by hand the Lotus Sutra, and has been doing for many, many years. And she went to a convention in London, at the Barbican, I think it was, of fellow illustrators who were all working on producing some kind of either illuminated manuscript or some kind of manuscript of one sort or another. And she met somebody who had been trained up in Chinese brush painting. And she got talking to her because there was quite a lot of overlap there. And this woman had said that when she went to her teacher, who was traditional Chinese and a brush painting teacher, she said when she went to her, she was already an artist. She was already quite an accomplished artist, but she wanted to learn this style of brush painting. And so she said she went there, and the teacher said, "Okay." She said, "We're going to start with a leaf. And you get your paper, you have your brush and your ink, and you make three lines along there, then one edge and the other edge." And she did this on the corner of a piece of paper, on a sheet of paper. And she gave her the paper and said, "Now, you take the brush and you just copy them." So she did one. And she went, "No, you see that line there? It's too thick. Do it again." "No, okay, that was okay. But this one was a bit messy towards the end. Do it again." And she went through this a few times, until she'd filled that sheet of paper with just these three lines, drawing this leaf. And she said, "Okay, that's not bad. Now go away and come back in a month and practice every day. Just the leaf." So she went away. She came back. The teacher said, "Okay, sheet of paper, off you go. Yeah, it's a bit too small. Make it a little bit bigger." Yeah, and after she got to the end of the second line, she said, "Okay, just fill the rest of the page. Yep, that looks okay. Right, now go away, come back in a month, and we'll see how you go." Came back in a month. This went on for 6 months. And the poor woman was beginning to think, this is just a leaf. You know, what happens when we get onto the bamboo? And she said that by the end of that 6 months, she could draw a leaf in the correct style, no matter what she felt, no matter what mood she was in, if she'd had a blazing row 5 minutes before, if she was feeling tired, it didn't matter. If she was feeling elated or she was anxious about something, it didn't matter. Because in that 6 months, just painting that leaf, that was the containment. And she had to do it every day, no matter how she felt. And imagine in 6 months how we go up and down on this wheel of life, round and round on this wheel of life. It didn't matter what she felt. It was quite irrelevant. Whatever it was would be comfortably contained within the form of just painting that leaf. And of course, her teacher said, "Well, that's fine. Now that you have that, you can go on and draw bamboo, you can draw the rocks, you can do the mountains, it's just a technicality. You just, there it is, that's how you do it." The point is that she actually had that, what was necessary to do it under all circumstances. And that's what a training does. That's what a training does, provides that strength, that inner strength. And when it comes to it, this is what walking the Buddha's way does. It cultivates that strength to, as much as possible, remain in a human state under all circumstances, good, bad, and indifferent. And when it comes down to it, we are all human beings the last time we looked in the mirror. And all other creatures manage it. You know, a cat is always a cat, and a dog is always a dog. And if you come back from from shopping at Sainsbury's and you've put your bags down in the kitchen, and the telephone goes, and you go and answer it, and it's an old friend who you haven't spoken to for ages, and you spend 40 minutes on the phone, and then you come back to the kitchen and find the shopping bag tipped over on its side, all the stuff on the floor, and the plastic bag with the wet fish in it ripped open, empty, and with the cats by the side licking its lips like that. Well, it's just the cat. That's what cats do. Cats, fish, they come together. It's called affinity links. And this is what they do. Sorry, Vladimir, I think it might be an idea to have the door open after all. It is getting warm. Thank you. And so in this way, actually, this is what the training does. For cats don't need a training to be cats. They're always cats. And dogs are always dogs. They live the way of the dog, and the oak tree lives the way of the oak tree. But human beings can be in any of these six states here. And this brings us really onto our verse, or our verse for today from the Song of Meditation, which goes, "The cause of our circling through the six worlds is that we are on the dark paths of ignorance, dark path upon dark path treading. When shall we escape from birth and death? The cause of our circling through the six worlds." Well, these are the six worlds which we looked at before, these six realms. And what he's talking about, of course, is rebirth. And rebirth in Buddhism is not the same as reincarnation. Reincarnation, sort of like the transmigration of souls, whether you were Florence Nightingale in a previous life and you were William Shakespeare in a previous life, or some such thing like that. This is not what we're talking about when we talk about rebirth in Buddhism. What we're talking about, because the Buddha said that there is no I, that it was an illusion. What is reborn are states of consciousness. These six realms are what are reborn. And the incarnations within the realms, this is what rebirth actually refers to. And so taken in this way, just cast your mind back to first thing this morning. What state were you in first thing this morning? Is it the same state as you're in now, or different? Do you imagine in an hour and a half, just before going into dinner, the state you're in now, will it be the same or different to the state that you'll be in then? And so on and so forth. After all, here we all sit. Butter wouldn't melt in our mouths, would it? Everybody looking quite peaceful, a little bit sleepy maybe, but otherwise fairly harmless, I suppose, all in all. You could be released onto the streets quite safely. So where does it all come from when it all goes off? Bang. Where does it all come from? These are the incarnating states. That flow is the flow of states, which is, of course, what samsara actually means. Samsara means aimlessly wandering about through a succession of states. And the states are these six states on the wheel. So we'll just have a quick look at that, because, of course, we talked about that carefulness. We talked about that giving myself. As a result of that carefulness and that giving myself, particularly staying with the body, then that awareness naturally arises. But the awareness isn't the end of the story in Buddhism. The awareness is the skill or the tool, if you like. It then becomes the tool for an inquiry, for an investigation. And what's investigated is this wheel of life, which is why you always find this wheel of life in every school of Buddhism. If you go to a temple or a monastery, you will find it somewhere near the entrance. And it's there to be shown, to be visible to all guests who come, no matter how many times they've been. And quite often it will be explained to them, and it's gone through again and again and again, because this is the object of our inquiry, these six states, which represent a map of our own heart. And this is why this cause of circling through the six worlds is that we are on the dark paths of ignorance. Yes, that ignorance. On the very rim of that wheel, there are 12 pictures which represent what's called the 12-fold link, the 12-link chain of arising due to conditions. Pratichit Samuppada is its technical term. To be honest, we can just regard it as the chain of becoming. It's how things become. It's the conditioning by which a particular state arises. Why is it that right now we're in a slightly, perhaps, soporific state, and yet another time we can be highly excited or agitated, and another time sad, or another time happy? This this chain actually explains the links in that process. And the first one, which you find just at 12 o'clock, actually is a picture of a blind man with a stick. And that blind man and this ignorance, the cause of our circling through the six worlds, is that we are on the dark paths of ignorance, are one and the same. The technical term, again, is avidya. And it simply means not seeing. Not knowing. That's what ignorance is. Being ignorant of something. And what is it that we're ignorant with? Well, it's what lies below the surface. That's what we're ignorant of. And that, according to Master Hakuin, is the cause of our suffering, because actually we're just wandering through incarnations, to this, to that, buffeted by the winds of those unconscious forces that blow us willy-nilly, not knowing that we're planting the seeds of anger, not knowing that we're planting the seeds of our own upset and suffering, blindly doing it. And this is why we continuously incarnate into these realms. And the Buddha, therefore, with his insight and teaching insight, was pointing the way out of that blindness, away from that ignorance. And so, having developed and come a little bit more into that awareness in the body, now living in the body a little bit more, we begin to turn our attention to the heart and begin to notice what comes. But first of all, we need one or two little things just to help us. And this is where the various training devices begin to come in. One such training device, which will be well known to many, is the good old timetable. For example, we have a timetable here, which tells us where we need to be at what particular time. And this is something that actually we can transfer a simple version of home as well. And usually it's just advised, as much as possible, to set a time for getting up in the morning, to set a time for going to bed in the evening. Now, I know people have different responsibilities and maybe shift work and so forth. So we always work within the circumstances as much as is possible. And the first thing that happens normally when we get a timetable, well, one of several things, depending on our character really, which way we tend to sort of lean, to which direction our attachments sort of lead us. Some people go for the timetable. They love it. All for it. And they come along and that you say, have you written your timetable out? Because it is advised that we write the timetable out. And they say, yes. And you say, and what does it say? And it says, well, I get up 7:01 and I brush teeth 7:04 and then I have shower 7:06. And it goes on like this along three pages until retiring at night. And so are you actually going to be able to do all that? And they said, well, I found that it's rather annoying because of the people that I live with, you know, I can't always seem to follow it. Well, it's hardly surprising. I mean, goodness me, I think the Desert Fathers and the old anchorites would have found difficulty following it. And they lived on their own and had no other distractions and didn't live a lay life and so on. No, that's too much. And that shows a particular attachments. It says that shows the way that I tend to perhaps overcram things. And for some people, they do overcram, always load things on and make it almost guaranteed to fail. That's one thing. And actually, interestingly, another group of people who often fall into that category, at least temporarily, are new fathers. A number of fathers to be have come up and said, you know, my wife or my partner is going to be, you know, having our first child, and I'm worried about the timetable. So don't worry about it. You know, there's nothing to worry about it at all, because once the baby comes, the baby's your timetable. You know, just simply obey the baby. The whole point of the timetable is just to stop us having my own way entirely. Well, a baby does that beautifully. And they go, oh, okay. And then about 6 months later, they come back and say, please, can I have my old timetable back? Say, in about 20 years, if you're lucky. On the other side, then there's the people who don't like timetables. You know, you dangle a rule in front of them and they go straight into the fighting demon realm. There's something there that really doesn't like it. And so usually after I say, how's the practice going? And they say, oh, fine. Okay. How's the timetable going? Yeah, okay. What time do you get up in the morning? 7-ish. Okay. What does your timetable say? It doesn't. Have you written it down? No. Write it down. And you see them again. You say, have you written your timetable down? No, I had a busy week. I do write your timetable. You want to do this practice. This is part of the practice. Nobody's forcing you. And this is the interesting thing, how the heart sort of works, you know. We get two conflicting desires inside us. One half wants to do the practice and comes along full of noble and good intentions. And the other half will do it, but only when it suits me. And when we have a teacher of something, it can be anything, actually. That person then takes possession of the noble ideal desire, the aspiration, and leaves me now to play hide and seek and escape and all those sorts of things as well. And I remember Soka Roshi once saying, laughingly, that his own teacher, as Master Zwiegand, said precisely of this. He says, whatever I do, you always seem to escape. I push your head down, you escape with your tail. Push your tail down, you escape with your head. That same thing. Of course, it's as if somehow somebody is oppressing us. But who is oppressing us? Who keeps us here? Look, the door is open. Yet we play these games. Who are we fooling? We pay good money to come here. We take time off work to come here. But we divorce ourselves into, and first we play this desire. And then if the teacher says, I'm not playing anymore, it's up to you. If you don't want to come, off you go. And Sokeyan, who taught for many years in New York, had a little notice on his meditation hall that said, everyone is free to come in, and if you leave, no one will come after you. Of course, that doesn't play my game, because then if I run away, oh my God, no one's come after me. What happens now? And then suddenly the other side comes up and I trudge back and say, actually, I do want to do this. And so we can go backwards and forwards, up and down in this sort of way, playing out these things. There's nothing, please, that these things are not to be regarded as sinful or anything like that. It is simply what the heart does. And it's getting to know that, getting to recognize the little games that the heart actually plays. And so, in this way, what is hidden over time reveals itself. When people go to Shobuan or Fairlight, for example, or go to any temple, sometimes, again, people go in with strong intentions that, right, they know that the temple life is going to be strict and feel that that's going to do me a lot of good. And it might do as well. But often not in the way I actually imagine it. And I remember somebody saying that they once went to Venerable Myokyoni and said, do feel free to shout at me or correct me to whatever degree you feel is necessary. Which those people who know Venerable Myokyoni will know perfectly well, she did not need that permission. walking through the door gave her that permission and the willingness to become a student. And she looked at the man and said to him, all intention misses the target. I said, what do you mean? He said, it's not necessary. It's not necessary. Now, here's some polish. You see that furniture in that room? Go and polish it. But surely, I've read about the sort of strict discipline and all the rest of it. You know, and here I am just doing a bit of polishing. Isn't to do the training properly. We need to have shouts and up at 3 o'clock in the morning and cold showers and long periods of meditation and all this sort of thing. 3 hours of polishing will sort most people out. Just do it. And this is what the timetable's for. Because with that timetable, what happens? First thing, I start the timetable first thing in the morning. No problem. Alarm goes, brrr, I'm straight out of bed. No problem. Second morning, brrr, 7 o'clock, I'm out of bed. Third morning, brrr. Well, I've done it twice. I think I'll just have to press the snooze alarm. And I press the snooze alarm and I turn over. And a little voice at the back of my head says, "But you're supposed to get out of bed at 7 o'clock as soon as the alarm goes off." Another voice in there says, "For goodness sake, well, I've already shown I can do it. 10 minutes won't matter." But it does matter, because this is all part of the discipline. "Oh, for goodness sake, those blessed Buddhists. I mean, they're all into discipline. And so I'm a Westerner. I have, we're independent and we're free thinking. We don't need all these sorts of blessed rules. But you're the one that decided to do it in the first place." "It doesn't matter. Well, they're your rules. Well, get out of bed. Go on." And that whole sort of conflict that goes in, and we may be sort of now just sitting there thinking, "Oh my God, is this what this is all about?" But actually, all this timetable really does is to produce this conflict that exists in every single dilemma that we face throughout our life. But it's done safely, and it's done in a situation that is not injurious to us, and that we can really explore it and discover it. And this is not something that's just constricted to or restricted to a Buddhist spiritual practice. There's the story of the monk, a Christian monk, who knew perfectly well that he had something of an irascible temperament. And he knew it was a real problem. And so one day, after really despairing about what to do about it, having had yet another blow up, he went into the chapel, and there he laid himself before the altar and before the cross and said, "Dear God," he said, "Dear Lord, please, please deliver me from this temper of mine." And for once, he felt something in his heart, as if somehow God had truly answered his prayer. And he got up and he felt lighthearted and he smiled and he thought, "Oh, thank goodness." And he went out of the church, and he hadn't gone three steps when one of the novices bumped into him with a jug of water, spilling half of it all over. "What do you think you're doing?" Yelled at him like this. A novice sort of shot off. He took another 15 steps, and somebody else he saw had nearly bumped into him, and he also, "What do you think you're doing?" And he hadn't even got back to his own cloister, and he'd already had sort of six eruptions. And he suddenly realized what was going on and rushed back to the chapel, and there prostrated himself once more before the altar and said, "But Lord, I thought you were going to deliver me." And a little voice inside his heart replied, saying, "Yes, yes, I will. I'm just giving you more opportunity to train with it." "Suffering I teach, and the way out of suffering," said the Buddha. But the way out of suffering is actually going through it, not running away from it, which is again why we learn to say yes to the circumstances just as they are. And so we look at these six realms and we begin to get to know them, not just out there on a sheet of paper or in a book or in a talk, but actually what it's like to experience them and to recognize them for what they are. The realm at the very top at 12 o'clock is known as the heavenly realms. Now, the terms heaven and hell appear on this wheel of life, but should not be confused, please, with the Christian understanding of heaven and hell. The Christian understanding of heaven and hell has to do with moral states. Heaven is good and hell is wicked. But actually, these states don't have that same connotation at all, because they're all states on the wheel of samsara, and they're all subject to change, and they're all subject to suffering as well. And in that sense, they are equal. But the experience of pleasure and pain is what makes them different. So the heavenly states are usually identified with a blissful state or with a state of delight or joy. But that's only really one layer, because if you think about, because you have to remember that the gods that we find in the heavenly realms in Buddhism were taken from the parent religion, Hinduism. And we know Hinduism has at least 2 million deities. But the Buddha looked upon them very differently. They were not seen as out there. They're seen very much as being in here. However, please don't mistake the gods for just merely being psychological elements, somehow personally related to me. They are not. They're absolutely not. They are forces that, in their root and essence, are quite impersonal and have nothing to do with me whatsoever. However, they animate us They're simply the names for the forces that animate us, that bring us into being and take us out of being, in the greatest sense at all, that inspire us to do the greatest things, that also inspire us to do the most terrible and heinous things as well. And if you think really, I mean, the deities of the stories connected with the deities of the Hindu pantheon are quite similar to those that we find in classical Greek mythology. For example, if you think of Zeus and Artemis and Aphrodite and Ares and Pan and so on and so forth. There's nothing particularly good or bad about them. They're just really elemental forces. That's what they are. And if you look at the stories, they most certainly gave us, according to the legends, they gave us things like the arts and science and agriculture and fire, very begrudgingly. But they also gave us, they also used to use us as pawns in their games. You know, Zeus would seduce and Hera would punish through jealousy and all this sort of thing. And they were all very capricious and they were all immensely insecure as well. If you slighted them, even tiny, you compare yourself to Aphrodite, you would probably end up being a spider or end up pushing a boulder or something like that. Anyway, you usually ended up pretty miserable as well. So despite the fact that they're tremendously powerful, they're also extremely capricious as well. They blow this way and that way. And really, they do represent those very elemental forces. And sometimes we can be possessed by them. We can be inspired, but we can also run amok as well. If you think, for example, in the Norse myth, according to the Norse mythology, Odin, who was the All-Father, he was the one who gave the berserker rage to the greatest warriors, but he was also the one who gave the gift of poetry as well. Very different, yet the same deity. Recently, I'm sure we've all been reading in the papers about the Anders Breivik, who got sent to prison recently after his murderous rampage. Every so often, these things happen. Somebody decides who will live, who will die. That's a very typical godlike state to be in, because gods decide who will live and who will die, who is human, who is not human, in that way. And yet the gods surprise us as well. They come at us in directions that we could never imagine. And there's the story of the devotee of the god Krishna, who went into the forest because he wanted to gaze upon the face of Krishna, the great god. And he sat under the tree and sat in deep meditation, chanting his mantra, Krishna, Krishna, when will you come and liberate me? Krishna, Krishna, when will you come and liberate me? And for 10 years, he determinedly and assiduously maintained his discipline. And at the end of that time, Krishna heard the cry of his devotee, and looking down from the highest heaven, he said, today, my devotee, you will be the day that you will gaze upon the face of Krishna. And so Krishna descended to earth and entered the forest and walked up behind that devotee who was still sat under the tree. Krishna, Krishna, when will you come and liberate me? Krishna, Krishna, when will you come and liberate me? And Krishna stretched out his hand and just laid it on the shoulder of the devotee, who slew round and said, go away, can't you see I'm meditating? Krishna, Krishna, when will you come and liberate me? And Krishna turned, rather crestfallen, and walked away. It's a rather sad story, really. But interesting to note that Krishna came not towards him with a great fanfare, but behind him, from the part of which he could not see. He was ignorant of what was behind him. Moving on, we have then about 2 o'clock, we have the realm of the Asuras, the realm of the fighting demons. And these represent those states of irritation, of berserker rage, of anger, And that too is an elemental force. Actually, in Asura, they're called the fighting demons. But please, again, they're not demons in the Christianized sense. They're demons in the Greek sense, daemons, meaning elemental forces. And in fact, they're otherwise known as the demigods. Is there anybody here who's not ever really had a stonking great rage about something or really been in a fury about something? No? Yeah? Okay. Then we know just how divine it feels. And how tremendously powerful it feels. How it can transform a stuttering, mousy, insignificant nobody into a magnificent, rapier sharp, eloquent, powerful creature. And then when it goes, back comes the mouse again. Tremendously powerful. It is truly a divine force. And the thing about these things is that, because this is something else, nowadays when we look at that dark part, that part that of the heart that isn't seen, we often think, oh, it's often called the subconscious, you know, as if somehow, you know, it's not anything terribly important. But actually, the things that are in there are alive. And these states are alive too, which is why it's important not to get too hooked on this idea that it's all just about psychology. Buddhism is all just about... Buddhism has a lot of psychology in it, but it's also a religion as well and shouldn't be forgotten. And religion transcends anything to do with the personal and goes beyond completely into the numinous, into the other, and into the transcendent. And therefore, when we start playing with those forces, we need to be very careful. And one thing that always struck me, because I have a great interest in, as you probably realize, in things like folklore and mythology also, is that I was always fascinated by the sort of medieval idea or the European idea of making a pact with the devil or making a pact with a devil. I think most people sort of know of it, so like rather like Faust. Dr. Faust. But actually, you come across it all over the place. The devil appears, and somebody makes a pact and says, and the devil says, you can have whatever you want for either 3 years or 7 years or 21 years, but at the end of that time, I drag your soul to hell. And people sign in blood on the dotted line, and they get whatever they want for 3 years, 7 years, 21 years. And then they get dragged to hell for eternity. And you sort of think, who in their right mind would make such a bum deal for that? I mean, there's 21 years even, and then there's like eternity, you know? I mean, you just see it's not worth it, it's pointless. And of course, really, it struck me, well, of course, nobody in their right mind would make that deal. So therefore, the deal has to be made unconsciously. We make those deals, but we don't realize it. And every so often, we run into those people who have made such a deal. And I knew somebody who had. I know, in fact, one or two people who have, but I worked with somebody who was like that. And he had made a pact with a fighting demon, with an Asura. And he discovered from quite an early age, obviously, that if you kick and scream and bang the table, you get what you want. Because most people don't like conflict and will run a mile from it and will give you pretty much anything you like. Yeah. To quite a high degree, if you really kick and scream loud enough. And actually, this made him a really good negotiating officer for a trade union. And he was very good indeed. And he was highly respected, but nobody liked him because nobody felt safe near him. Because what happens is over time, having discovered this, perhaps only semi-consciously, one uses it, one reaches out and uses it and uses this force and uses this force. And of course, this force grows and it grows and it grows until suddenly it takes on a life of its own. And then it came to the point where, in fact, he had a hair trigger temper. And even the tiniest things, the tiniest uncomfortable situations could set him off if he couldn't get his own way. And I remember once a friend of mine who worked on the reception, this chap came in and absolutely blasted her for something, which actually had nothing to do with her, as it turned out. And this woman, this friend of mine, she wasn't fazed by this. She knew this guy very well. And so when he'd finished and he sort of walked off to his office, she called somebody to come and cover reception. And then she went up there and sort of walked straight in and leaned over the desk and said, "Don't you ever do that to me again. For a start, it had nothing to do with me, blah, blah, blah," and really let her have it. And he sat there all contrite, hands up, "I'm really sorry," he said. "I've had a bad meeting and you were the first person I, you know." So it had got him. And that's him being dragged off by it. That's him being dragged off by it. Now, in his case, it was a fighting demon. With somebody else, it might be a depression. With somebody else, it might be another thing. But these things really do take on a life of their own. And then they can make our lives hell. And so we need to be careful about them, yes. Though, actually, fighting demons can be tremendously useful as well. I remember Venerable Myokyo Ni saying, she said, if you find that you have some kind of real upset that comes, she said, she had a particular method for dealing with it. She used to keep a little pile of socks that needed darning because she hated sewing. And whenever she got into a state, then she would sit down and she would take that energy and then she would go put it all into that. And she said, you know, nobody can darn socks like a demon. At the end of it, the darning was beautiful. It was the one thing that really impressed me about Buddhism, that according to the stories, the Buddha did convert demons to Buddhism, but they didn't lose their demon nature. They still had that wildness, that elemental, temperamental spirit. But what did he do with them? He put them on the gates of by the gates of the temple in order to guard the Dharma. Because in Buddhism, it is not that any of these things are either good nor evil. It is only how they are applied. Everything has its place in the universe. It's just a matter of finding where it fits and then allowing it to make good use and to fulfill its nature. This is what it means by saving and assisting and liberating sentient beings too. Remember, those sentient beings are the beings here. Moving on, we have the animal realm. And the animal realm in Buddhism is different to the realm in to animals in the West. We either have a sort of dual view of them. We either think of them as beasts, you know, he's a pig or he's a wolf or some such thing like that, or a dog, or we regard them as sort of like child substitutes, little puppies with big eyes and sort of, oh, and all this sort of thing as well. But actually in the East, and certainly in Buddhist iconography, the symbol of the animal represents a state of ignorance. It represents a state of being subject to forces beyond your control and having no redress with regards to them. And if you think, really, perhaps the best illustration I can come up with, you know, sometimes on a summer's day, a fly flies in at the window and it flies around the room a bit, and then it flies back towards the light, towards the window, and it goes boop, boop. And there's an open window here, and it goes right the way up here. And then looks like it's going to go out, and then goes. It's ignorant of the escape route. It's just driven towards the light. That's all it does. It just gets attracted, a stimulus response towards the light. And human beings can be like that as well. When one of these powerful desires or aversions takes us over, it just compels us. That's what we mean by compulsion. And it acts in blindly. And that's the animal state. The hell states are the ones at the bottom. And those are the miserable states. And we may think, well, yes, we know what those are all about. But actually, we should never think with these six states, oh, yes, I know what they are, switch off. Because they all have nuances to them. And not only are there the states, but they're also how we react to those states as well. And how we react in those states as well. Because even in the miserable states, we can become rather fond of them in a strangely perverse way. And there's the story of Jürgen, who was a book that was written in the 20s and 30s by the American author James Branch Cabell, It was a sort of one of these early fantasy stories about a man called Jürgen, whose wife is abducted. Well, she's not actually abducted. He wishes her away. One day, it sort of takes place somewhere in the old country, you know, somewhere central Europe, 18th century, early 19th century, something like that. And it starts with the bell to the church is ringing, and all the seminarians are rushing back to the church because they're late for mass. And one of them trips on the cobble and comes hard face down. And Jürgen, who happens to be standing by the side, when he hears the priest curse the devil who put that stone in his way. And Jürgen, who's a little bit on the pompous side, says, "Oh, you shouldn't, you as a priest shouldn't be condemning the devil. After all, he gives you your work, you know. You'd be out of a job if it wasn't for him, you know." Of course, this priest was the last thing he wanted to hear and rushed off. Anyway, Jürgen feels sort of rather good about himself, walks straight round the corner, slap bang into this rather tall, dark-looking gentleman, who says, "Jürgen." Jürgen's rather surprised that he's referred to by name by this stranger. And the tall gentleman says, "Jürgen, I want to thank you for defending my good name. Now, and in order to reward you, I will grant you a wish." And Jürgen, of course, immediately realizes who he's talking to and realizes that he doesn't want a wish from this one. And he says, "No, thank you, I really don't." And Jürgen, and the gentleman says, "Oh, come on, Jürgen, there must be something. You can wish for anything." "No, no, I really don't." The taut gentleman says, "Jürgen," he says, "I know you have a wish, and I can see into your heart, and I know what it is, and I've now granted it." And the problem is that he recently just had a wife, an argument with his wife, Dame Lisa, and by the time he shot home, she had vanished. And he felt terrible. Anyway, long journey starts, and he now tries to get her back. And his journey takes him first to heaven, and then his grandmother, whom he meets there, says, "Oh no, I think you'd better go, because the only person who might know where she is your uncle, who happened to be a minister." And he said, "Yes," he said, "that's why I've come to heaven." "Oh no," she said, "he didn't come here, he went to the other place." "Oh," he says, rather surprised. And so he goes down to the other place, and as he approaches the gates of hell, there are two sort of demons sort of lolling by the side, who are supposed to be guarding the place. And as he walks up to them, they sort of sit up and smarten themselves up, and he comes, because they're not used to people voluntarily coming to the gates of hell, he sort of says, "I've come to see, do you happen to know if my grandfather is here? His name is such and such." And he said, "Well, we don't know him, but we have quite a lot of people in here. Why don't you come in and talk to Grandfather Satan? See if he might know. He lives in the Iron Palace over there." And so he goes along goes into the Iron Palace, and there is Grandfather Satan sitting on his throne in this rather dank and gloomy place. And he has a face as long as three rainy days. And Jürgen says, "What's wrong?" And Grandfather says, Satan says, "Oh," he says, "this place. It's this place." He says, "What is it?" He said, "It's the people here." He says, "It's such hard work." He said, "We do our best. We really do our best to look after our customers here," he says. "But you know, they all come here saying, 'I have sinned. I have sinned. My sins are so terrible. They are so special that I need a special punishment meted out just to me, to nobody else, because my sins are so special.'" And he said, "We have to rack our brains again and again to come up with some special torture for them in order to please them and satisfy them all." He said, "Because they all of them think they're so special." And a little bit, it might sound curious, but we can get a little bit like that with my own miseries in that way, that make me special, and therefore have difficulties letting go of them, my problems, in other words. It's a curious thing. On the one hand, I really want to get away from them, but on the other hand, they actually tell me who I am. And no I wants to lose his own identity. And then we're coming to the last realm that we're going to deal with today, because we've really run out of time, and we can deal with the rest of it tomorrow. But that last realm, or this fifth realm, is the realm of the hungry ghosts, which in fact we talked about a little bit yesterday. With that, a good example was that little girl in that video shop. More, more, more. And whether it gets its what it wants or whether it doesn't get what it wants, it comes back. And of course, it is this restlessness, this feeling of a lack, because in order to, and this is the important thing to understand about desire, in order to have desire, to feel that a desire for something, we have to feel that something is lacking. Without that sense of a lack, there is no desire. So whatever the object of our desire is, becomes the symbol of our fulfillment. And this is why it is so compelling. And the stronger that lack we feel it to be, and that feeling can be quite unconscious to us sometimes, the stronger that feeling of the lack, the more powerful the desire, the more fascinating the object, and the more compelling the object actually becomes. And so this is why we practice this, keeping this good form, which actually belongs to the human realm, which is the sixth realm, which we will look at in a little bit more detail tomorrow. But on the inside, really get to know that power that comes up on the inside. And when those two come together, it's then that a transformation begins to take place. And we'll talk about that more tomorrow.